I'm Sean Crawford. WUIS recently held its first engagement event focusing on education and the local economy. Chris Farrell was the guest speaker at the Hoagland Center for the Arts. Farrell is an economics editor for the public radio show Marketplace, as well as Business Week magazine. He's a graduate of Stanford and the London School of Economics. Today on Illinois Edition, a special program, we hear remarks from Chris Farrell.
And what I want to do is take a step back and take sort of a broad view, thinking about education and economic development, and then come in more toward the local economy. But most of all, what I really want to do is get to your questions. So I don't want to talk too long. And then we can have your questions. You can, for elaboration on my remarks, challenging my remarks, we can talk anything about the economy, education, personal finances. Let's just for a moment talk about the economy and what's driving the economy. And not for today or next year or the next 3 years, but let's talk about the next, what are the major forces that are going to drive this economy over the next 5, 10, 15 years? And of course, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to go on, and many things that we don't know are going to happen are going to happen. But I think there are four major forces that we're going to be responding to. And these four major forces are also going to interact with one another and reinforce one another. So the first major force is globalization. I mean, that jargon term, that abstract term, which essentially means when you look at goods, services, and people, between nations, they're increasingly integrated. And the story of globalization is a story of two steps forward, one step back. So you go back to the 2008, 2009 downturn. There's all this commentary that, of course, nations were going to become protectionist. They were going to put up all kinds of trade barriers because of the bad economic times. They didn't do it. But now we have a step back with what's going on in the Ukraine and Putin. But again, two steps forward, one step back. Globalization is a story of our era. The other major economic force is the digital economy. You know, it's really amazing to think, you know, the personal computer, what, 3 decades old? That the commercial possibilities of the internet, we really didn't even think about it until August 1995, when Netscape went public. And through the booms and the busts and all the hype and the disappointment, this digital economy has taken deeper and deeper root into our economy. So automation, algorithms, software, robots. And now I think the symbol of this digital economy and where it's going and how transformative it's going to be, and it's just one symbol, is the Google driverless car. Now, if you're in Northern California, there's a lot of them on the road. You don't know that because by law there has to be someone sitting in the driver's seat, but they're not actually driving. And in 5, 6, 7 years here in Springfield, there's going to be a Google driverless car. And this opens up all kinds of possibilities of thinking about transportation, even the practicalities of an aging workforce working longer, all kinds of things. The third is the job market. And attaching more and more people, not just to the job market, but to the job market with decent jobs and prospects for a decent career. And it comes under different terms. I mean, a lot of it's being discussed in terms of income inequality. How do we have more social mobility? How do we have more economic opportunity? But I think it's really about jobs, jobs with decent pay, and that this is going to dominate our public discourse for the next 2 decades. For those of you who remember the 1970s, remember that high and rising inflation. And there was a period of time in the late 1970s where the elite opinion basically believed there was nothing that you could do about inflation. Inflation was the democratic disease. Lester Thoreau, zero-sum society. Arthur Burns, former Fed chairman, when he stepped down, goes off, gets a big award in Switzerland. He says there's nothing we can really do about inflation. All central bankers can do is just, you know, try and keep it below 10%. Maybe we'll get it around there. Paul Volcker, 3 days later, gets up and gives a speech called A Time of Testing. And he says, nonsense. This talk about inflation is inevitable is nonsense. And now we're living into a period, 3 decades later, where we're worried about inflation is too low. So Narayana Kochilakota, who is the head of the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis, gave a talk about A Time of Testing, that over the next 2 decades, we're going to be trying to figure out ways to have a more robust job market, to attach more people to the job market. Because whether you're looking at issues of poverty or you're looking at the issues of an aging population, the primary solution is going to be the job market. And then the fourth one is the aging of the population. I know it's stunning news. I know you have never heard this, but guess what? The baby boom generation is getting older. And in fact, from now until 2030, every day, 10,000 boomers turn 65. And this is a story of our era. And we're going through this period of time about rethinking retirement and what does that really mean to have an aging population. So these are the four economic forces that I think are determinant. These are the ones we're going to be reacting to over the next 5, 10, 15 years. So what's the thread that ties them all together? What ties them all together is thinking about education. And in terms of the solutions that we talk about, they all involve a more educated population. And if you look at U.S. economic history, and I cannot prove this, but I do believe that if you look at U.S. economic history and you look at certain periods of education in our society, that you can map investments in education and U.S. economic growth. Because what has happened in our society is that we have become increasingly a society that values human capital, knowledge, skill, and education. And Gary Becker of the University of Chicago a couple years ago did a calculation that the value of human capital in the U.S. is 3 to 4 times the value of every home, every commercial office building, every car, every stock, every bond, every asset that you can come with in the U.S. economy. Human capital is worth 3 to 4 times. And that has been the story of our history. So we go back to 1862 and the Morrill Act that created the land-grant colleges. Land-grant colleges are still around. And they're still important. They're still part of our economy. Well, the land-grant colleges, this is when we called it an agricultural republic, but it was a natural resource republic. And the land-grant colleges were really critical to creating some of the knowledge and the productivity in agriculture and in mining and in timber. And then you jump and you go to what is one of the most remarkable moments in the history of the world, which was the high school movement. You go to 1910. 9% of 18-year-olds had a high school degree. And most of them had come from well-off families, and they'd gone to private schools that had pretty high tuition, which is why it was mostly limited to the well-off. And if you looked at what was going on in our economy, this is the rise of mass production, electrification, the beginning of the real office, the railroads, time was really what mattered a lot. And business worried over and over again about a lack of skilled workers. And public leaders worried about the United States falling behind other nations. Does this sound familiar? And so here was the incredible. What state and local governments did was a massive investment in free public education. And here was the insight. The discussion in Europe, and discussion in much of the U.S., about education was it was about building character. It was moral uplift. That's really important. But the radical idea in the United States was that economic growth didn't come from capital. It didn't come from technology. It came from people and training. And so we invested in this open system, open to men, by and large, open to men and women. And by 1940, more than 50%, the graduation rate in high school was more than 50%. The next big stage in education was the GI Bill, which we all know. And it simply broke down the barriers to college to a generation, many of them immigrants, who would never have been able to go to college if we hadn't had the GI Bill. And that filled IBM and all the companies that became the major global multinational corporations of the U.S. And then David Warsh, who's a wonderful columnist, he wrote a piece about how important was the next big stage, which was the NDEA of 1958. Sputnik had happened. The U.S. was falling behind. And so we made a massive investment. Essentially, what the GI Bill was the college, the NDEA was the graduate school. And Warsh makes this very clever argument, and I think it's a very smart argument, that that investment is essentially what won the Cold War. And because that was the scientists that then taught. But then what happened here, and this is the fascinating part about education. Education is real supply-side economics. It's decentralized. You don't know what's going to happen. So the NDA, the funding, was to create the scientists who would then create the bombs, who would then create us, and we would go to space, and we would colonize Mars. And at the 50th anniversary of Sputnik, there was all this, you know, boy, we wasted all that money. We just wasted them. We haven't had much space exploration. It's such a big disappointment. And what Warsh pointed out is, no, you know what? We didn't go to space, but we created a mouse. And those were the people. That investment is what really led to Silicon Valley. Those investments that were made in breaking down the barriers to graduate school and putting a generation in the graduate school are the ones that ended up creating Facebook. Now, you may think that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that is what they did. So one of the things that happens when you have a major economic downturn like we've been through, an economic trauma, is that it accelerates an underlying trend. It doesn't create the trend. It accelerates an underlying trend. And we have, you know, we've talked about education. Education is important. But I think what this downturn has accelerated is the realization, this real message, is the importance of post-secondary education, the way the economy is evolving. So post-secondary, certificate, community college, BA, advanced degree, but it is post-secondary education. And it is post-secondary education that provides the opportunity. It's what the philosophers call a necessary but not sufficient condition. They have the opportunity for a kind of the career that is going to offer benefits, that's going to offer opportunities for to have advancement. And we have moved towards society. Back in 1970, 21% of middle-class jobs involved post-secondary education. 2007, according to the Georgetown Center of Workforce and Education, it's about 61%, and I believe their latest numbers is about 65%. You know, the modern workplace is really inhospitable to the less educated worker. And if you look, I know that, you know, if you right now we're having this discussion about, oh, it's terrible out there for all these young college graduates. It's really awful, and it is true. You know, wages have stagnated for more than a decade. The unemployment rate, it has been very high. And it has been a tough period of time. And we have a system that relies too much on debt. Young people have taken on too much debt in order to get their education. All of that is true. But if you take a look at who has really suffered during this downturn, it is the less educated. They're the ones that have really been hurt. And that the better educated, the students with post-secondary education, continue to have opportunities. Manufacturing. 36% of the workforce in manufacturing now has some form of post-secondary education, some form of college. That's triple what it was in 1970. Mining and farming and fishing. In 1970, two-thirds of that workforce was high school dropouts. One-third of that workforce now has some form of college education. And this is the way that I do believe that the world is going. So we have to deal with things like student loans, and the financial aid system is an absolute mess. And there's all kinds of reforms that need to be done in terms of how we better pay for college. And by the way, we also have to be careful about not getting too carried away with some of the student loan debt burdens, because in my profession, we usually start out a story about someone who borrowed $100,000 for their undergraduate education. But the fact is, if you look at the data from the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, that's 4% of all borrowers. The average student loan is $25,000, and the median is $14,000, rounding off the numbers. Those are still high if you're graduating. And I always love this thing. 1955, Milton Friedman, the late Nobel laureate, you know, wrote a wonderful essay. And what he drew an analogy is that an undergraduate, not a graduate, but an undergraduate is a very risky asset. An undergraduate is much riskier than a small business. And therefore, he was arguing at that point, this small business, this risky asset, this young undergraduate, should not have too much debt because simply it's too risky. And I think he's right. And we need to move away from that. But the wrong message to take away is that a college education doesn't pay. We're moving toward a society where education is more and more important. And I think how this evolves is really going to be striking. We have all this turmoil that's going on. We have the MOOCs, which is, you know, the online learning. And part of, I think, why the MOOCs is, you know, gaining so much credibility is that it's just a wonderful acronym to say. Hey, what do you think about the MOOCs? Yeah, you like the MOOCs? What do you think? MOOCs. So, but, you know, online learning has been around for a long time, and some of you will probably remember, you know, Plato. I mean, Plato was part of online learning. And I was interviewing this gentleman who was, he'd been running an online learning in the 1990s. And he said, you know, we had really, really good ideas. And the fact of the matter is the technology wasn't there. I mean, you know, the broadband wasn't there, wasn't strong enough. We didn't have good enough software. It was really pretty boring, and it was very disappointing. And now the infrastructure is now strong enough, much more robust, that the online learning actually is a better experience. But you also have brand names, University of Illinois, you have Harvard, you have Stanford, you have Rice University. I mean, you have so many other universities are moving into this online world. That's exciting, and it's not exactly clear how this is going to play out. As with all technologies, there's a lot of hype. But again, there's stuff going on. And so what I think about education, it's very easy to have a conversation of, among people, and we all do it, about how bad this situation is. I mean, you know, look at these numbers, look at what's happening here, what's happening there. And I actually think what we're living through is an incredibly exciting period of turmoil, and that we're living in a society that absolutely knows that education is more important than ever. And so the investments that are going with the online, I don't know how it plays out, but it's going to play have a factor. And I also think that we're doing this very, very difficult shift to realizing that education is throughout a lifetime. And there's this jargon term about lifetime learning. And you mentioned lifetime learning and people roll their eyes back, right? We've heard this before. All right. Well, here, I got news for you. As I said, the baby boom generation is getting older. But the thing is, the baby boom generation wants to continue to work. And they not necessarily want to continue to work at the same place. They may not want to see the same colleagues. They may not want to work for the same boss. They really want to say goodbye to everybody. But they want to continue to work. And so there are these very fascinating institutions coming out of Silicon Valley that are coming up with certificates. And, you know, it takes 8 months to get a certificate. One of the companies that I've been doing some work with, they're with UCLA Extension Service, which is a brand name, and coming up certificates that are amenable to someone under 55 trying to make some sort of a transition in their life, picking up some kind of additional skill. And the education system, the community college system, they have these older workers showing up, these older entrepreneurs, trying to figure out how to deal with them. And I think this is an extremely exciting development. This is where a lot of the drive is going to come, increasing the education. Because one of the things about our whole discussion of education, it underestimates how important is the job. And this really came home to me. I was in a seminar. This is in the early 1990s. And it was Jacob Mincer. He was a great University of Chicago economist, one of the pioneers in developing the whole theory of human capital. But he had moved to Columbia University. And this is by the early 1990s. This is when it's really apparent about this widening wage gap between high school only and college only. So I called a bunch of people together. I was lucky enough to be invited. And Fisher Black was also there. And Fisher Black was the Black-Scholes model, the great quantitative financier. At that time, he had left MIT, and now he was at Goldman Sachs. And he didn't say anything, actually. And we're having this conversation about how do we deal with this wage gap between college and high school. And then Fisher Black goes, why are we talking about this? It seems to me that most people learn 9 to 11 times on the job what they learn in school. So shouldn't we be talking about that? And Jacob looked at him and goes, well, you're right, Fisher, but that's not what we're here to talk about. He was right. And so one of the things that I think that that is going on with an aging population, with the digital economy, with globalization, is that through a difficult process, we're going to end up going in and out of our educational institutions over a longer period of time. And that is part of the big shift that is going to happen that I see going on. Because when you're on the job and you're learning something and then you realize what it is you don't know, you actually want to go out and learn it, as opposed to somebody telling you this is something that you need to learn. So in terms of local economic development, you know, I've been on a lot of panels and, you know, local economic development, and it usually devolves into discussions about tax breaks and subsidies and clawbacks and all kinds of conversations about that. And I can't be naive. I mean, I know that, you know, we live in a competitive environment. But when you really think about local economic development, it's about having an educated workforce. And that is the fundamental competitive weapon that is out there in any society. But the problem with education is, first of all, it's always a mix of the effective and the ineffective, and it's also the ultimate supply-side economics. Because what you're investing in is it's extremely decentralized. You're investing in the education of somebody, and you don't know what they're going to do with it. You don't know where they're going to live. You don't know what they're going to do with that education. And it's essentially a trust me moment. But that is the payoff. And if you think about employers, they want an educated workforce. And I think more importantly in terms of economic development, local economic development, is one of the most fundamental and best changes that is happening in our society, which is if you look over the from the late 1990s till now, we talk a lot about entrepreneurship, but if you look at the fundamental shift, it has been to lower rates of entrepreneurship. And the reason why is basically it reflects the rise of Walmart, Home Depot, a lot of the national chains. You look at CVS and Walgreens. You know, back three decades ago, about 70% of the pharmacy business was independent pharmacies. That's now down to about 10%. So it's that phenomenon has really sort of hit the entrepreneurial stage. I think there are two reasons to be very optimistic about entrepreneurship going forward. One reason is the aging of the population. And if you're laid off at 50, 55, you know, it's hard to get a job. But what you do have is you have a network. You have some skills. You have some contacts. And a lot of people are going to put out their own shingle, or really their own website. And they're going to be doing their own work, and they're going to be turning to educational institutions to pick up some of the skills that they need in order for their business to succeed. A younger generation has seen their parents and how tough it is, and that there is no such thing as corporate loyalty. And what is striking to me when you look at young college-educated graduates is how many of them have a micro-entrepreneurial project in their back pocket, that they have something that they're doing that really engages them. And the creative economy is encouraging this. The creative economy was 5% of the workforce in 1900. It's now over a third of the workforce in 2012. And it's going to continue to grow. So if you think about local economic development, well, the knowledge that we have is that educated people succeed more in small business than less educated people. Because, you know, it's really complicated to run your own business. It's a lot easier in certain ways because we have the software and you can do contract labor and it's easy to set up a shopping cart. But it turns out all these things are really difficult to juggle. And therefore, educated workers actually do better in terms of local economic development. And the world has changed where people are thinking about starting their own business, having my own something on the side. And so I think for a local economic development and education, to a large extent, we talk about it in terms of employers want an educated workforce. Well, what I say is that a lot of Americans want to own their business. And that's what an educated workforce allows. And I think more and more people, we're moving toward a society where people are not going to, when I graduated from college, which was not the dark ages, okay? But it was a while ago. You know, people, they would go to the private sector. They would go to law. They would decide to go into nonprofit. They would decide to go into government. And there are a couple of people over here, you know, going the entrepreneurial side. You know, today there's all kinds of mixtures. People work the private sector, and then they shift to the nonprofit sector, and then they think about starting their own business, and they do their own business for a while, and then that fails, and they go back to an employer. And I think there's a lot more merger, you know, just sort of flux going on in this economy. And so that flux, that upheaval, that turmoil, really the only thing that we can do as a society that really to make that turmoil succeed, that creative destruction in Joseph Schumpeter's famous expression, is to have an economic, an educated populace. So I think education and local economic development are two sides of the same coin. And so when someone says to you, well, what do you think we should do to develop our economy, just simply say education.
You're listening to Illinois Edition on WUIS. Today we're hearing a recent WUIS engagement event featuring Marketplace's Chris Farrell. He was in Springfield and spoke on the impact of education on the local economy. Now Chris Farrell answers some questions from those in attendance.
Hi, you've spoken mostly about higher education, but could you give some insight into the need for high-quality elementary and secondary education as that relates to the impact on the local economy?
So, yes, I did mostly talk about higher education. So I think that if you look at the issue about income inequality and how that is being discussed, And how are we going to address that? And there's lots of ideas that are out there that are being discussed in terms of raising the minimum wage, increasing the earned income tax credit. Where I think you're going to have a consensus, and the consensus is really growing, and it's coming out of the scientific community, it's coming out of the economic community, it's coming out of the educational community. It's the next big wave and next big investment in terms of education in the United States is going to be in early childhood education, particularly 0 to age 4. And it's not just going to be education. In a way, we need to move away from that word education because it's education and healthcare, and it's bringing both the healthcare community and the education community together. And that is really going to be the next wave of investment in education because it's pretty convincing. The data and just common sense basically tells you. But the data is actually really quite convincing that those investments pay off over a lifetime in terms of increased productivity, in terms of lower incarceration rates. So, you know, you just go through everything. And so I think that whenever the United States has fundamentally wrestled with the issue of income inequality, the preferred solution has always been a solution that involves education. And so early childhood education, particularly early childhood education with at-risk children, I think is the next big wave, and that is going to continue. The high school graduation rate came out. It topped 80% recently. And, you know, I think what's going on in sort of the high school level is a mixed bag, but overall, I think if you take a step back, and many of you will know better than I do, between everything that's been going on, you know, No Child Left Behind, the Common Core, the charter schools, the accountability movement, I mean, lots of things, that if you looked at the high school graduation rate and you used it as a measure, you know, the high school graduation rate went way down, and now it's gone way back up. And so I think we're starting to see in the aggregate that you can't point to any one thing, but there are a lot of efforts that are going on. And when you look at the data, it seems to me that most of the problems are associated with poverty, low-income families. Early child education is going to be part of it, and a more nuanced discussion about education in low-income communities involving a lot more in terms of after-school programs, preschool programs, health programs. It's sort of a more nuanced and richer dialogue that is going on as opposed to just standardized tests, which has been a lot of the dialogue up till now. So it may be that I'm just a genetic optimist and that's just the way that I was born, but I do think that this ferment that's going on, this sort of upset that's going on, people being deeply dissatisfied, you know, when people are deeply dissatisfied, I think 10 years from now when we look back, we're going to realize that some things really succeeded because people were upset.
Thank you so much for your comments. I really appreciated, in particular, your mention of student debt, which is something, as a university chancellor, is something that's very high in my mind all the time. We're a public university at the University of Illinois, as you know, so we're really one of the more affordable ones. But regardless of that, I had a conversation with a student just yesterday. I'll be shaking his hand in a few days on the commencement stage, and he's got $52,000. In debt, which is more than double the average. Would you comment on what you think the solution to this great challenge is?
So if you go back to, and you would know, but if you go back to the early 1990s, what's really striking is you don't really see student loan debt. I mean, I know there is a line there and there's some numbers, but it's really small. And so you go from the 1990s till now, and we have this absolute explosion in student loan debt. And it's over $1 trillion. Now, some of it, when you look at that $1 trillion figure, some of it I'm not quite so upset about because what it also reflects is a lot of people went to college who might have gone into the workforce, but because it was a bad economic time, so they went to college, they're adding to their education. But nonetheless, we have a system that relies too much on student loan debt. So if they made me dictator for the day, which I've always been arguing for, and no one ever seems to pay attention. But I think what we're going to move much closer toward is a system that Australia has adopted, Britain has just adopted. Australia did a couple years ago, Britain just adopted. And we have an option in our student loan repayment system, which is the income-based repayment plan. That is essentially what you're doing is you're moving away from a loan-based system to you're paying it off back through your earnings through the tax system. So it's essentially an earnings-based return as opposed to a loan-based system with a repayment schedule and then some options. Because with the undergraduate, now graduate school I think is a very different beast. If we're just talking undergraduate, and think about your 18-year-olds. How many 18-year-olds really know what they want to do? And how many of you said to your 18-year-old going to college, look, explore. Find out what your passion is. Find out what you really want to do. Please take a statistics course or two, please. But really explore what it is you want to do. And from 18 to 21, you can go through all kinds of changes. And there's standard advice that, you know, in the personal finance, we say, you know, don't borrow more than your first year income. Well, who at 21 years knows what their first year income is going to be? Graduate school, you can figure that out. So I think what we really are going to move more toward a system is you pay back through the tax system. You pay back through your earnings. And essentially that we become an income-based repayment system. And then at the same time, the financial aid system itself has just gotten way too complicated. I think that, you know, really needs to be fundamentally reformed. And the final thing, there are really two systems that we have. Well, there are three, but you have the state systems, and then you have the private nonprofit colleges. And I think that the state system, simply if you look at the past 25 years, I don't know specifics about Illinois, but if you look really overall, the states for the past 25 to 30 years has been a dramatic drop in support for the tuition. And then we had just simply put too much on the students. And it was a conversation that was started with saying, look, there's all these huge returns toward getting an education. And so if you're going to get this big return getting an education, you should then borrow and then pay it back rather than have it done through society. A little bit of that, I think, is actually quite healthy. You can talk about owning your own education. But we now move too far. Because what has happened over that period of time is family income, if you look at the numbers, family income has gone nowhere, except for a very small segment of society. Family income's gone nowhere from 1978 till now. And if you look at just tuition and fees of colleges and universities, it's up 1,200%. Healthcare is up 600%, food's up 240%. So it's just simply reached a point where we have to move away from student loans. I think we're going to copy the Australians and the British and go more toward an income-based repayment plan system overall, which does mean, by the way, people who end up with high-earning jobs are going to pay more than people who end up with low-paying jobs. And that is part of the social cost of having greater freedom of choice, which I'm perfectly comfortable with. But that's what a lot of the debate will revolve around.
Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and I'm so proud of the collaboration we have with the University of Illinois, all campuses, but especially, of course, in Springfield.
One of my great courses in college was on Abraham Lincoln.
That's a good thing. And there's also Lincoln's relationship to Illinois and beyond. But specifically, have you seen examples where there is a exciting collaboration between museums, not only in institutions of higher education, but perhaps urban education in general?
So my impression, now this would be more shaped by three places that I know a little bit about, which is I live now in the Twin Cities, I've lived in New York in the Bay Area. And I think there's actually a fair amount of collaboration that is going on. And what it reflects is two things. And part of it, I think, reflects a bad thing, which is, you know, we live in a society where we talk about creativity. We talk about the arts. Of course, we don't want to fund those things. And those are being cut in a lot on the local school level. And so what's happening is a lot of museums are stepping in, but they're also able to get funding in order to step in. So they're getting funding from foundations. They're getting funding from wealthy philanthropists to help fill in the gap, tying more into the school system as far as using the museums as educational institutes to fill in part of the gap, because what we are moving toward is the arts is expendable in an era of tight budgets. And so I think it's quite exciting, actually, like the Minnesota Science Museum, what they've been doing, and part of it is just, you know, using it as a classroom, part of it is having competition. The Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and all the other Federal Reserve banks now run in terms of competitions in economics and teaching economics in the high schools to encourage that. Minnesota Public Radio does a lot. We really moved in a lot in terms of working with schools in terms of classical music and bringing classical music into the classroom, because a lot of the schools in Minnesota have had to cut back or eliminate their music programs. So a lot of institutions that you would think, okay, so Minnesota Public Radio, it's, you know, okay, now we're multimedia, but fundamentally we're a radio, you know, is having a much stronger relationship with the schools in terms of thinking about music and teaching about music and working with musicians and bringing them in. I think museums are doing a lot more work in terms of collaborating with the classroom and bringing the classroom into the museum. And then there's a sort of patchwork quilt of funding that is supporting these kinds of activities. And I see that growing as opposed to getting smaller, because for each institution, one of the things in the world that we moved in, and I think this is probably true for most nonprofits, you cannot be an island unto yourself anymore. And so it's all about one of the real management challenges. And I think it's a management challenge in for-profit. I think it's a management challenge in the nonprofit sector. Is the real skill in management now is how do you manage partnerships? That's a very different skill than managing your own organization. It's how do you manage partnerships? How do you manage egos? How do you manage the money flow? How do you collaborate and actually end up where 2 + 2 does equal 5? And so I see more and more of this happening in an era of scarce resources, in an era where it's very hard to come up with the government doing big support or increasing its support, and there's a lot of pressure on government to be more fiscally responsible, as we all know. So the nonprofit sector and the education sector need to work more together and see how they can each fulfill their own mission.
Good morning. I'm a healthcare practitioner and also a healthcare educator at the associate degree level, and I'm in a profession that, luckily, we're in that top 10 in the Department of Labor. It's occupational therapy.
Yes.
And everybody loves OT right now. But now there's a big initiative for this degree they want OTs to have a doctorate degree as physical therapists. They want the assistants to then have bachelor degrees. So the degrees are just creeping up and up and up. Yeah. So those of us at the associate degree level are saying, what's going to happen to this workforce? What are we going to do when everybody needs a higher degree? And those opportunities for education are going to dwindle rather than increase for those people in the community to get that degree. And can you speak to, you know, those forces are coming externally, not from the profession saying
no, we
need
right.
more education, but they're coming externally from departments, Department of Education and
yes.
other things.
That is a trend that I don't see changing very much. I mean, I think that you're absolutely right that it is going to continue. And you would know better than I, but what the work is going on, particularly right now, is hospitals, for example, are taking a lot bigger role in terms of working with their unions, if it's a unionized workforce, in patching together sort of programs in order to make it practical so that the people can get time off in order to get this education and fund at least part of that education. So there seems to be a lot of activity going on within the medical complexes to try and address the situation that you're talking about. And part of also what's going on here is, are we going to, and I think we are, that, for example, nurses are going to end up doing a lot of the work that doctors do now, but people are going to want some sort of certificate that says that a nurse has a certain level of qualification, whether or not that's right. All right. I mean, the whole thing about a certificate is it doesn't necessarily say what we think it says, but it's being built into the system. One of the things, and I know this is not your question, but I do want to move, is I think one of the things that needs to happen in healthcare and needs to happen in education is there are all kinds of barriers toward moving from Illinois to Minnesota. So you have a certificate. Okay, come on to Minnesota. Well, it turns out it's not quite that easy. And there's been a bipartisan effort to try and make the certificates easier transferable for families of military, because it's been a real problem where one spouse is in the military, and typically the other spouse is in education or healthcare, and you're moving every 2 or 3 years, and your certificate's no good as you move into the next state. And they're trying to carve out exceptions for the military. Many states are changing their laws a little bit And my sense is, well, why not just get, you know, you should be able, we're a mobile society. You're Illinois, you want to come to Minnesota, you should be able to come to Minnesota very, very easily. And that, I think, is one of the things, if we're going to move toward these greater, increasing these requirements need to be increasingly transferable around the country. And one of the things that's really striking is if you look, if you go back and you go to the early 1950s, essentially 30%, a little over 30% of the private workforce was unionized. And you had about 5 to 6% of the white-collar workforce had certificates. You now, if you go to 2012, it's about 5 to 6% of the private sector workforce is unionized, and about 30% of the private sector workforce now has certificates. And so I think we really do need to, if we're going to be increasing these requirements, we need to make it mobile. And we need to be able to not have these barriers to trade, which I think is really a big mistake.
Back to the economy a little bit. Yeah. The unemployment rate came out today at 6.3% or whatever. And you and I both know it's more like 12 to 15% because we have a labor force that's getting so many benefits from the government that they've totally dropped out and decide not to look for work. So I'd like to hear your comments on tying those benefits to training and educating those labor force to get back into the system.
Okay, so we'll have a fundamental disagreement in that I think that most people want to work. And the benefits are just simply not that generous. And anyone who's been on unemployment insurance, I mean, you want to get back to a job as fast as possible. And I think that we're going to see a real shift. The unemployment rate is 6.3%. The payroll growth was 288,000. So as the job market gets tighter and there's more opportunities to go on, I think more and more people are going to, you know, not give up, are going to move back. And essentially what a lot of people are going to do is move from the underground economy to the above-ground economy again. I think there is a fundamental point that I do think is something that we really do need to be thinking about in terms of, for example, our disability benefits. So if you think about disability, it's either you work or you can't work, and there's no in between. And actually, a lot of people with disabilities want to go back to work, but they can't necessarily go back to work full time, or they can't do what they were doing before. But they do face a real problem that if they go back to work, it really has implications on what they can earn. And so there's a lot of discussion going on about there, you know, how do we modify the disability system so it would encourage people to continue to work, which, by the way, has health benefits, which, by the way, keeps the mind going and keeps the body going, and at the same time not turn it into an either-or penalty. So when we're thinking about incentives, I do agree that I do think we need to be thinking about training. We need to be thinking about incentives to keep people in the workforce. But to a large extent, the reason why I think people are not working is the demand hasn't been strong enough. I think it is going to be picking up. And a lot of people who have retired, who have taken Social Security at age 62, did not want to take Social Security at age 62, did not want to drop out of the workforce, which is where a lot of you see that drop in labor force participation rate. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see a lot of suspension of Social Security as this economy gets stronger. But I do agree with you in that we really have to think about incentives. And one of the things I think that is going to be going on in the society is there's been a lot of work done with, you know, employer tax credits. You know, what do we use in order to make it more attractive for more employers to hire more people in this economy? How do we make it more attractive for more disabled people to continue to work and continue to earn a paycheck? As opposed to what we really kind of had is it's all up to you, and it's an either-or. But where I would disagree is I just don't think the benefits are that generous. I just don't think they encourage that many people to drop out. Some, but not that many.
You mentioned earlier that people learn more on the job than they do in the classroom. What do you see in terms of employers investing in training their workforces once they're on the job?
They don't want to. So there's a statistic that's out there. You've seen variations of it. McKinsey company survey, and 60 to 65% of management say they can't find the skilled workers that they want. But when you actually look a lot more closely, what it is they can't find the skilled worker they want at the price they want to pay and not invest anything in their training. Because my response has always been, okay, give me 2-3 weeks. I can find a list of 45 to 55-year-old workers who have worked all their life, who are willing to learn more, and they can do that job. Trust me, they can do it. And that's not really not what they're looking for. What I think is happening, and this is not going to change, and whether it's, you know, some companies do invest in training. Now, I want to take back. So Accenture, your consulting firm, that's the core of your business. You're going to invest a lot, actually, in the education of your workforce. And one of the things, as an aside, it was interesting. I was talking to Accenture about education, and they used to invest a fair amount in their 50-year-old workers, teaching them about technology. And what they have realized is they have to start investing in their 30-year-old workers in terms of technology. Because, we all have this sort of stereotype prejudice. Young people know, it's just genetic. They understand all this technology. Well, it turns out they don't necessarily have partners. They don't have kids. They don't have a whole lot of responsibility. Well, now they're working, at a company like Accenture. They're working 50, 60 hours a week. They have kids. They're trying to do some nonprofit activity. And all of a sudden, they're not keeping up with the technology. They're realizing they need to invest in it. So some companies are doing it because it's in the nature of the beast. But overall, I think this is what part of one of the transformations in our economy, which is that it's being outsourced to the community college system. And the community college system is now going to be, is becoming and has been the training system for many companies. And it's going to be a combination of the community college and online training, which companies actually have invested a fair amount in the online world. And the MOOCs, I think, is going to really, the big impact, I think, of the MOOCs is not going to be on undergraduate education, it's on corporate training. So it'll be between community colleges and online training where corporations will turn to, and there'll probably be much more of a benefit where you might get some money in order to make it happen, but they're not necessarily going to invest their time in you doing it. It's up to you. And they have realized that they can do that. It lowers their cost, and that's what they're going to continue to do, unless there's some sort of competitive reason where it's in the nature of their very business that they have to do it. But again, I think this is all part of moving toward a corporate attitude. And I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing, where you're much more of a independent entrepreneur within the company. You're much more responsible for your career. Companies are now a lot more, some of the advanced thinking companies are not just thinking, okay, well, we have a 401k and you have an employee's healthcare system, but okay, so you probably do want to do a second career as you get older and you leave us, and actually providing the opportunities for their workforce to start adopting those skills and helping them learn those skills. So it's not all bad, but I think it has been outsourced to the community college system, and it'll be outsourced in some form or fashion to the MOOCs.
Thank you for bringing up the term MOOC again.
But I love it.
Along those same lines, how do you see this really playing out with the evolution of MOOCs, Khan Academy, things like that, where there's this open and free access to so much information?
Yeah.
How will that affect the traditional higher ed institutions, first of all? How do they monetize that? And then secondly, will those institutions, in your view, be the mechanism for which employers can verify that there's real value in the MOOCs or whatever the online training may be?
Okay, so you've raised what is the real... Okay, so there's a couple of things. By the way, for anyone who's kind of interested in the underlying economics of MOOCs, John Cochran, who is a professor at the Business School at University of Chicago, taught a MOOC, and he wrote a blog post about it. And it's really underlying the economics of the MOOC itself. It's really quite thoughtful. And it's a lot more expensive than anybody thinks, as we all know, in terms of these things. I think you hit upon what is the real issue. So is it possible that you take a robotics course, and it's a year's course, and you do well? Will Intel decide that's all they need to know, that you're a worker that they want to have on their staff? Because you think of what does a college education really say? Yes, sometimes it's a specialized skill, but what a college education really says is you can learn. And you can complete your task because you got your degree. And so that's how the employer, they decide, that's one screen that they use. If a MOOC provides the same screen, it's a lot cheaper for everybody. Now, we don't know. Is it going to evolve that direction? Will it go that way? There's been some interesting experiments that have been done by a couple of the companies working within sort of the high-tech area where they have actually done this and it actually worked. But it's still, you know, one of the real issue there, as in many issues, is do people believe the credit? Do they believe that this is a real certificate? So that's an open question, and that will fundamentally change the economics of a college education if that happens. What I think the more important point of the MOOCs is what is going to happen is it's still colleges and universities, the face-to-face is incredibly important. And it's just going to change the way that we do part of the learning, and it's going to make that part of the learning much richer. But it's actually going to continue that some part of face-to-face is still going to be critical.
That's Chris Farrell of Marketplace speaking at a recent WUIS engagement event on the impact of education and the local economy. If you missed some of his remarks, you can find this program on our website, wuis.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Thanks for listening.